Hello and welcome to Medley's Podcast, Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Medley East and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. Human Rights Watch released its annual report on human rights situation around the world on January 16th. The reports on the five Central Asian states showed that respect for basic rights and freedoms deteriorated in 2024. Authorities in Central Asia are tightening their control over the countries, often using loosely worded laws to eliminate political opposition and silence critics. In the meantime, social problems such as gender-based violence are growing due to insufficient legal protection. So what is in the latest Human Rights Watch report on Central Asian countries? To discuss all this, I am joined by Sinat Sultanaliyeva, a researcher covering Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan for Human Rights Watch, and Hugh Williamson, the Europe and Central Asia Director for Human Rights Watch. Thank you both for joining me. We do have a lot to talk about, but I was hoping we could start with the media situation, which includes the situation with bloggers. I know Sinat has something to say about what's happening in Kyrgyzstan, but Hugh, could you speak a bit about the media problems in the other Central Asian countries?
Sure, and of course, and thank you so much for having us on the program, Bruce. It's really nice to be back. Yeah, the media situation across the region is pretty bleak. I mean, generally during this conversation, let's try to recognize there's been progress in some areas, setbacks in other areas. So we'll be sort of trying to identify it. It's hardly ever an entirely black and white situation. But broadly speaking, I would say the situation on media freedom has remained bad or got worse during 2024. We have some statistics in our chapter on Turkmenistan saying that over 120,000 websites are blocked in Turkmenistan. So ordinary people find it very difficult to or impossible to access international media sources. VPNs, which help people access, foreign websites, are also blocked in many situations. And there's no independent reporters in any case in Turkmenistan. The situation in both Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan is also difficult. In Uzbekistan, the crackdown on bloggers has continued. There's been some broader, since Mirziyoyev came to power, a little bit more space for some media to work. But bloggers have been a target because they see those as covering sensitive issues, often at the local level, and several bloggers were detained and charged this year. Similarly, in Kazakhstan, a couple of other bloggers and activists who work in the media were also harassed this year. So it's a bleak picture across most of Central Asia. Sinat, do you want to touch on Kyrgyzstan?
Yes. So the situation in Kyrgyzstan with regards to media freedom has really worsened compared to previous years. Now, granted, of course, this is nothing new. There have been defamation lawsuits in the past against opposition-affiliated outlets and journalists. There are April TV or Next TV. There have been lawsuits against outlets like Zanoza and others. But it's only in 2024 that we've seen an actual imprisonment and sentencing of journalists and also a closure of an award-winning investigative media outlet, Klop Media, basically. And that's all just, in 2024. And as you may remember, as you may know, in September, the Kyrgyz Supreme Court upheld an earlier order for the liquidation of Klop Media. And it was alleging basically that Klop Media had failed to register as a media outlet. So that was like a technical reasoning or justification for the closure. But then the case itself that the prosecution brought forward against Klop Media included several charges, including charges of public calls for the violent seizure of power by some of the articles published on Klop Media. And then in October 24, four of the 11 current and former journalists associated with Temirov Life, an investigative outlet that was exposing high-level corruption in government, were found guilty of calling for disobedience and riots, which at the time, they had appealed several times throughout the year, but then four of the journalists had been eventually found guilty. Two were sentenced to 6 and 5 years in prison. One of them is Volodymyrov's wife, and two of the journalists were sentenced to probation.
Okay, thank you. Sinat, let's talk a little bit about the laws that make possible putting these people in prison. I mean, you mentioned the one was the violent seizure of power. This is really weird. This law seems to be aimed at seditionists, terrorists, somebody like that. But and yet they're able to use this law to go after the media. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, this law is, it's not a specifically new law. It has always been there. It's just the use for this law that has become somewhat of a signature move, I guess, for this specific regime, or like the government regime in Kyrgyzstan, because the number of cases that were brought forward with the public calls for violent seizure of power, or public calls for, or calling for disobedience and mass riots, these are two different ones, actually, they have proliferated. These cases have proliferated in the past 4 years. And that's really just sort of symptomatic of the, let's say, I guess the tightening or the shrinking of the civil space that's been driven by the authorities and by the desire of the authorities to really clamp down on dissenting voices, on critical opinions. And it's another very interesting thing that to note here is that in all of these cases that have this charge, among others, of course, because that's also another thing that in many of the cases against journalists, or like, for example, Globe Media, it's not just one charge, right? There are several charges that are brought against them. But for these specific ones, the authorities always employ so-called specialists or experts, linguistic expertise or political expertise, as they were saying, or political science expertise. And usually these are people who would be tasked with analyzing, with reading basically the articles and coming up with conclusions, whether, you know, this is sedition, or not, whether it's calling for violent seizure of power, for disobedience and riots. And of course, in 100% of the cases, the experts would find that, yes, these articles were indeed calling for that. Except that there was, you know, Globe Media have done such a great job of really covering the year-long process against them with the court trials and, you know, the witness statements, the statements of these experts. And it's just really, it's laughable, really, the kind of evidence or lack thereof, really, that the experts present during the court hearings. There are just really no criteria, no actual scientific criteria on which they base. So a lot of the times they will say, well, if you read this, you will get a feeling that you are being incited to hate the government. But what is the grounds for making such claims? The experts don't really provide information. And it has been, of course, assumed that, or discussed in sort of like the wider discourse in Kyrgyzstan, that majority of these experts are really kind of pro-governmental, or they're not independent, basically. So their independence is really questionable here.
Well, thanks for mentioning that. And I just want to make sure everyone understands it's not just the media. There was that woman pensioner, she's more than 7 years old. And a couple of years ago, she posted on Facebook that prices were going up in Kyrgyzstan, and where is the justice? And on that basis, they actually convicted her of calling for mass unrest. In the case of the journalists that you mentioned that were from Tamirov Live, wasn't there a part two where they wore shirts that said fight for freedom or something? And they put that out to the so-called linguistic experts to see if that wasn't a call for unrest?
Yes, there was something like that as well. I mean, it's just, to be honest, the accusations were really ridiculous. And the journalists have really responded kind of to the absurdity of this request by also wearing further kind of t-shirts during the court hearings, which would have very kind of freedom-related slogans on them.
Hugh, I want to go to Kazakhstan for a minute, because Kazakhstan is doing the same thing we're seeing in Kyrgyzstan with the calls for mass unrest, but they're actually saying it's extremism. They're using that, a very loose definition of extremism, to go after people. Is this true?
Yeah, that's a good point to make about last year, because Kazakhstan for many years has been misusing its definition of extremism in the criminal code, which is very broad and vaguely worded to, in a sense, rein in any opposition the authorities see to its rule. A few years ago, they banned some small opposition parties based on the accusation that they're extremist. And they've also imprisoned some fairly high-profile opposition leaders on those grounds in 2022 and 2023. And they continued that this year, in 2024. In August, there were two activists figures who were jailed each for 7 years. That's such a long prison sentence for peaceful activities of being allegedly associated with a small banned political party, being associated with an extremist political party, as the authorities say it. So that this misuse of extremism laws has continued. And another aspect which came up in 24 was also their continued use of this what they call their financing terrorism list. For people who were charged and prosecuted and jailed for being extremists, not only is that enough punishment for them, but when they come out of jail, after being in jail for 3 or 4 years or even 7 years, they continue to be harassed because they're put on a list of people who are seen as having financed terrorism, even though their charges may not be violent in the first place. Nevertheless, they're put on this list. And being on this list really limits somebody's ordinary life. It's very difficult to get a job if you're on the list because you're seen as being on a blacklist. It's difficult to process your healthcare or other sorts of payments, have a bank account, and that sort of thing. And we've actually looked into that in more detail last year. We published a report about it, and we had evidence that there's about 1,400 people on this list at the moment. So there's different ways that Kazakhstan is misusing its extremism laws, in a sense, for its own political purpose of reigning in the way the opposition tries to organize in the country.
Okay, thank you. And since we're talking about this extremism and also terrorism, Sianat, in Tajikistan in 2024, the Pamir Daily News, which to be clear is not does not come out of Tajikistan at all. It's done by Pamiris who are outside the country. It's available only on the internet. But the Tajik government put them on the terrorist list, right? Can you explain what the situation is with Pamir Daily News that got them on the terrorist list, up there with Al-Qaeda and of course, the Islamic State of Khorasan province and Pamir Daily News?
Yeah. Well, it used to be called Pamir Daily News. It's now called Pamir Insight. And it is an independent news portal that's providing anonymous coverage of events in Tajikistan, focusing specifically on what's happening in the Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Oblast. And I think it's also key here that it is indeed anonymous. So like they don't have, you know, journalists out there openly reporting. They have a very good connection with diaspora groups and then also people from within the GBAO, the Autonomous Oblast, who sent them reports on what's happening there. But as you said, they're not within Tajikistan. And this outlet has, I mean, the reasons for it being pronounced a terrorist organization probably has to do really with the fact that it was pretty much the only outlet that has actively and regularly covered the crisis in the Gorno-Badakhshan, starting from November 2021, when protests sort of began in the capital of the province in Khorog, through to June 2022, when at least 40 people were killed during the crackdowns on the peaceful protests. Dozens of activists, lawyers, journalists, human rights defenders were arrested and were presented with trumped up criminal cases. And since then, we know of probably of several hundred Tamiri people who have been arrested in connection with the protest and are serving really lengthy prison terms in Tajikistan. And I'm saying that the Pamir Daily News was the only outlet that was actively covering it because also back in already, I think it was in June 20 or maybe even mid-May 2022, another independent news agency, Asia Plus, stopped covering the events in the GBAO after the General Prosecutor's Office issued an official warning to them that for them to avoid closure, they would need to stop covering or like stop, as they alleged, one-sided reporting of what's happening in the Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Oblast. And apart from Pamir Daily News, it was only really Radio Free Europe that was covering the issue, but again, not as regularly because Pamir Daily News would post almost every day pretty much and also would have interviews with some of the people, with relatives of those people who were detained and other issues. So yes, I mean, I think it's very much connected to the fact that Pamir Daily News remained basically one of the last important and regular sources of information on this, which resulted really in the Supreme Court of Tajikistan declaring it an extremist organization and banning its activities in the country, which led to its renaming. And I think it's also worth mentioning that Pamir Insight or Pamir Daily News is available on Telegram as a channel. They do have a website from what I know, but I don't think it's available from within Tajikistan or you'll probably need a VPN to access it. But the Telegram channel really does its job anyway.
Okay, thank you. We've mentioned a lot about media outlets, but since we were just talking about these laws, I mean, they have an effect on civil society also at the same time. Or anyone that wants to try to do it, that has some kind of grassroots political movement or trying to form a party. Hugh, can you talk a little bit about how the government uses these laws or other instruments to affect the space for civil society?
Sure. Let me start. I mean, let's go back to Turkmenistan. I mean, there's no free independent civil society in Turkmenistan, unfortunately. But I think it's always important to focus on what's happening in that country. I wanted to mention the case of Soltan Achilova, who is a veteran human rights defender, so a one-person activist group, in a sense, in Turkmenistan. She's 75 years old. She's been doing it for some time, for many years. She was awarded a human rights prize this year by an international organization, the Martin Ennals Foundation, and she was due to leave the country in November last year. But surprise, surprise, on the day that she was due to leave, some medical experts in white coats came to her house and claimed that she was ill or infected or was the source of infectious disease, and they rushed her off to hospital and basically imprisoned her, jailed her in hospital for several days, 6 days, in order to stop her leaving the country and going to pick up her prize and thereby, you know, draw international attention to the terrible human rights record in Turkmenistan. She did not have a chance to leave at all, which is such a scandal for such a courageous and honorable woman not being able to leave the country. And that's just a sign. I mean, it's also draws attention to the other restrictions in Turkmenistan. For those who are inclined to be independent-minded, it's very difficult to travel outside Turkmenistan, isn't it? You know, the freedom of movement is heavily restricted. In other countries, of course, there are heavy restrictions on the way NGOs work. Maybe Sinat in a moment should talk a little bit about the foreign agents law in Kyrgyzstan, but also in Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan. Many independent groups, let's take Uzbekistan, many human rights organizations have tried for many years to register as an independent body. They tried in 2024 as well, but failed to be registered. In Kazakhstan too, one non-governmental organization who is linked to women's rights organizations and domestic violence, maybe we'll talk a little bit about that later in the program, has tried to register 7 or 8 times and was denied permission to do so. So the legal restrictions on what the government allows in terms of organizing are very tight. Restrictions on protests are tight as well. We've just heard in the last few days that women's activists in Kazakhstan were trying to organize their traditional March 8th International Women's Day rally. They've tried every year for the last few years and usually been banned doing so, and they've been banned again in 2025 in doing so. So yeah, there's not a lot of positive news regarding non-governmental organizations and civil society in those three countries, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan. Perhaps, Sinat, do you want to pick up on Kyrgyzstan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in Kyrgyzstan, I think we've talked about it, and not just myself, but like several other guests, right, on the Majlis podcast in the past, about the foreign representatives law that was signed, that came into force in Kyrgyzstan last April. Since then, to be honest, at this point, really not much to report apart from the fact that this law is still there. And it, as really assumed from the very beginning, that it wouldn't really have, I mean, the authorities wouldn't really have the necessary resources to really make it work, right? Like the machinery to make it work in a very en masse kind of a way. But maybe it doesn't even need that, because just the fact that the law is there, that serves already as a warning sign, right, to NGOs, to many NGOs, to really think about their activities, whether their activities fall under the vaguely defined political activity criteria in the law that's described in the law. And that has really kind of like led to a sort of a self-censorship on the part of the NGOs. And we really are seeing it, the effects of this law already in what's been happening, let's say already in fall months of 2024, including with the coverage of the cases against the journalist, or, for example, the case against criminal lawyer Samat Matsakov, which you may have heard of. He's a lawyer who's represented some of the journalists from the Timir of Life case. He has also represented some businessmen who were accused of, you know, preparing a coup or like a violent overthrow in Kyrgyzstan and some others. So very like kind of high profile cases. But in those cases, again, or for example, again, just to add, say the crackdown or the repression, persecution of the Social Democrats Party of Kyrgyzstan and their members, right? So there has been a chain of events that's been happening in Kyrgyzstan in the last few months of 2024, but we really have not, unfortunately, seen a lot of the local NGOs and human rights defenders saying anything as vocally as they used to be able to do before. And I don't want to say that the, you know, civil society has been really scared into silence, but I think it's more about civil society and human rights defenders, NGOs, becoming more cautious, right, as to what they will be saying and which cases probably warrant, right, being very publicly critical of the authorities and, you know, the cases that are happening at that time. So, for example, in the case of the lawyer Samat Matsakov, there have been some statements from the local and international organizations as well, of course. But, for example, in the case of persecution of the Social Democrats, less so, because this is such a politically charged case that maybe many NGOs didn't think that it would be safe for them to really voice their opinions here. So, I mean, we haven't really, still haven't heard of the registry itself, you know, like working or like organizations receiving any kind of notices. But again, like I said, just the fact that the law is there and that the possibility of organizations receiving such a notice at any point in time is already kind of, I guess, risky enough.
I just wanted to ask you one more thing. I mean, it, in my capacity as a journalist, to be clear, I've attended several protests in Kyrgyzstan over the course of many, many years, or at least I was out there to watch and see what happened. There was a level of professionalism in protests or public rallies that you didn't see in Central Asian countries. If you were going to have a rally in Kyrgyzstan, someone showed up with a generator, microphones, platform for people to speak on. I mean, it was all set up very, very quickly and fairly well organized. That's like completely disappeared. You don't see that anymore. How did this government manage to get rid of something which had been going on for years in Kyrgyzstan and make it so that it just disappeared?
Yes, agreed. I mean, it used to be a signature, I guess, feature of the Kyrgyz civil society to be able to hold rallies, to mobilize very quickly. And unfortunately, this has gone in the past 2 years, or maybe, I guess, it's 3 years now. And that's really all down to this blanket ban on protests that the authorities have introduced back in March 2022 already. And that was in relation to a series of like this kind of unexpected or like unplanned protests and meetings to protest the war in Ukraine. And that's really led the authorities to kind of ban the protests. And then since then, I guess it just seemed like a good thing to do, a nice idea on the part of the authorities that, oh yeah, we can just keep on extending it. And that's exactly what they've done. And that same protest ban has been extended yet again in 2025 until the end of March. So until the 31st of March. To be clear, of course, this ban on protest is only within Bishkek. So in the other regions of the country, it's still, I think, more or less possible. Although some, I guess, cities and towns might have their own versions of the ban. But already the fact that Bishkek has such a massive blanket, basically, ban on any kind of protest, any kind of meetings within the within Bishkek, that's the biggest contributing factor to the fact that we just really haven't seen a lot of protests. I mean, there have been some smaller scale protests because the protest ban doesn't ban just like all of the protests altogether. It allows a very small, it left us a very small pocket in Bishkek where protests can be held. And it's really far away from public eye, from the public eye. It's kind of not very central, but it still gives an opportunity for NGOs to organize, or not only NGOs, but just people in general, right? And citizens to come and organize. But yeah, the ban has really broken, I guess, the ability of civil society to organize larger scale, you know, marches and demonstrations through the streets of Bishkek, which used to be possible in the past. And just an interesting note, at the Kurultai, I think, last year in December 2024, President Japarov, or was it at the Kurultai, or maybe some kind of a concluding press statement that he gave, he boasted that, oh, you know, since I've come to power, since we've been doing our work here in Kyrgyzstan, we haven't had protest, even a single protest. And it's just so funny how he thinks it's because people have nothing to be critical about or to go and protest. You know, has no critical awareness of the fact that maybe that's because of the protest ban.
Yeah, I agree. Hugh, I want to get back to Kazakhstan for just a second. I mean, some of what CNN just said here really kind of applies to Kazakhstan. They've said we're not against protests, but they've put out designated areas. And more recently, after your report came out, we've had a problem with a comedian. And you did mention there was problems last year in the report in Kazakhstan with humor that Kazakh authorities apparently didn't find to be very funny. But my understanding was you could at least have a one-person picket, what they call them, or one-person rally. That was within the law, and you didn't have to get permission as long as it was one person. But we saw at least four people detained this week holding single-person rallies downtown. So can you talk a little bit about what is the right, what is the freedom for public assembly in Kazakhstan at the moment?
Indeed. It's been a long-standing issue. Even a few years ago, Kazakhstan came under a lot of pressure from UN bodies to liberalize its freedom of assembly laws, and they made some tweaks to it, appearing to make it easier for people to register to protest. In reality, it is still very difficult to hold a legitimate rally, as we've seen from the recent examples of one person protest being shut down. I've been to, you know, I've seen protests in Kazakhstan where, or heard about them, where, you know, spontaneous events where people gather and then they're immediately broken up by the authorities. So it's a typical example in Kazakhstan, isn't it, really? Because on the one hand, the government likes to tell its international partners, its interlocutors, that it is, of course, it's possible to hold protests in the country and we're tolerant of them. But in reality, the difficulties of organizing that, of getting the registration, getting somewhere in central Almaty or Astana to protest, mean that it's actually almost impossible to do so. So yeah, it's that double-sided aspect of the way Kazakhstan works, presenting a positive face to the outside world, to the international community, but in reality, being very intolerant of any independent voices or opposition protests.
Okay, thank you. And a reminder, we're talking about the recent Human Rights Watch report on the situation in Central Asia in 2024. And my guests are Hugh Williamson, the Europe and Central Asia Director for Human Rights Watch, and Sianat Sultanaliyeva, a researcher covering Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan for Human Rights Watch. Let's move over to some of the social problems, and specifically gender-based violence. And this is something that all the governments, maybe not the Turkmen government as an exception, but all the governments have at least made statements about this. And some of them have enacted new laws that are supposed to protect women and children against gender-based violence. And yet, all the statistics show that the problem got worse in 2024. So, Sianat, can we start with you and talk about that? Because I think in Kyrgyzstan, they said they had 37% more complaints in 2024 than they did in 2023 about gender-based violence?
Yes. There have been also numerous fatal cases of gender-based and domestic violence against women. I mean, in the report, we list at least four of these cases, pretty gruesome cases of women just being murdered by their partners, either, you know, spouses or domestic partners. So Kyrgyzstan is considered to have the most progressive domestic violence legislation or protection from domestic violence legislation. And yet the problem remains that, unfortunately, the implementation or the practice of these laws remains subpar at this stage. And to a point that some police chiefs who were responsible, who were found to be really, to not have acted, right, on certain cases, when there was plenty of evidence to really go ahead and act, they just remain in service, basically, in police. And there is just really no accountability for their lack of action in that sense. Yet at the same time, in Kyrgyzstan, there has been some development. So it's not all negative, of course, and there's some positive developments. But again, it's really from the sphere of legislation, right? And in August, for example, a new law was signed into force, which basically enhances protection against family sexual and gender-based violence. And these amendments specifically, which is a really good development here, these amendments eliminate the possibility of reconciliation in cases of rape, sexual assault. It increases penalties for battery, and it also removes eligibility for probation for those who have been already convicted, right? Where a person who convicted of sexual acts with children under 16, convicted of bride kidnapping or forced marriage. So that's really a good development in the sense. Now, whether it's implemented, how it is in practice, of course, that remains to be seen. And that really is something that the civil society in Kyrgyzstan used to be very result-oriented or productive with in the past. But considering that civil society in Kyrgyzstan is in general under attack at the attack in the moment, including women's rights groups, I mean, it's really unclear how exactly we'll be able to kind of call for better implementation of this law or the previous laws. Then there was also a one window support center that was opened in Bishkek by the government. And the idea of this one window support center is that it provides all the necessary medical, psychological, and legal help to victims and survivors of domestic and gender-based violence in a single location. Whereas in the past, they would have to, you know, travel from a police department to a medical examination place or, you know, for psychological support to another place and, you know, that kind of stuff. So now all of that is gathered in one place. And one other really kind of positive development concerning violence against women, but specifically women with disabilities. In September, the Kyrgyz parliament initiated legal amendments. They still haven't passed yet, so we're monitoring this at this point. But they have been initiated, which basically strengthen protection for persons with disabilities against sexual crimes. So the proposed provisions would include harsher penalties for offenses against, for sexual offenses, basically, and the sexual freedom of persons with disabilities. Again, eliminate the possibility of exemptions from imprisonment for those who commit sexual crimes against persons with disabilities and extend protective measures to persons with disabilities, regardless of their gender and age. So those are some of the good things. Now, just very quickly, I guess I could also talk about Tajikistan. Unfortunately, Tajikistan has long been one of the sort of countries in Central Asia who did not have domestic violence criminalized, and it still doesn't have that. In July 24, we have read news that senior, kind of like from a statement from a senior government official saying that a draft law criminalizing domestic violence was in development, but it's really unclear when it would be submitted to the parliament and other things. So it's something to keep following, of course.
Perhaps I can come in there, Bruce, to talk just for a moment about Kazakhstan. I mean, I mentioned that because, I mean, sadly, in terms of the international media coverage of Central Asia, many people will remember the sort of the blitz of coverage that took place in April and May of the case, awful murder case against the former economics minister of Kazakhstan, Kwandik Bishambayev, who basically murdered his wife, Saltanat Nukanova, in a most brutal fashion and filmed some of the incidents, and those films were shared on social media and so on. It caused a huge stir, controversy within Kazakhstan and interest around the world. I mean, in a way, thankfully, that case spurred the government into action. Around that time, actually in April last year, President Tokayev signed a new law into force, strengthening protections for women and girls against domestic violence, gender-based violence, which is an important step forward for the country. It's something which women's groups, Human Rights Watch and others have been calling for many years. It doesn't go as far as we would hope. I mean, it would be much better if in a criminal law like in Kazakhstan, the specific offense of domestic violence was criminalized. It would be easier for the courts to deal with that if there was a specific standalone offense. Perhaps that will come in the future. Let's be optimistic that Kazakhstan's moving in the right direction and that this law will be implemented because, like in Kyrgyzstan, there have been many high-profile cases, sadly, in Kazakhstan of ordinary women, not just, you know, the partners of high-profile politicians who've been killed or badly abused by domestic violence. And I'll just say quickly, the case I referred to earlier of a non-governmental organization being denied registration to do with women's rights, that was to do with this case. Sultanat Nukanova's brother has tried to register a foundation to support women in her name and memory of her life. And that's been denied registration 5 times, which is really difficult to understand why the Kazakh government would do that. But that's the sort of developments there. In Uzbekistan, we should remember that Uzbekistan's also a couple of years ago passed a law against domestic violence and is in the process of implementing it. We've been talking to women's groups there who are very courageous in their determination to make sure it's implemented in a strong and clear way. So these are all situations to watch very closely and support in 2025.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning Uzbekistan too, because of course the Uzbek president's daughter has actually championed the cause of greater rights and for women, and yet we still have this. You know, even in Uzbekistan, where the media is not as open as it is in Kazakhstan and not as open as it is in Kyrgyzstan, you still get these reports pretty regularly about domestic abuse, women being killed. You know, problems there. But I also want to mention a little bit one more thing about Kazakhstan. You mentioned their cannabis brother, but there's also Namalchi.kz, right? They've also championed women's cause, but they had charges against them. The other group, Feminita, has had problems that also champions women's rights, and they've been rejected to hold rallies and demonstrations and stuff. I don't want to leave them out of the picture either. Can you talk a little bit about Namalchi.kz and Feminita?
Yes, indeed. It's good to focus on these cases. Feminita is indeed a worrying case in the way you outlined it. Namalchi is one we've also documented in our own reporting and mentioned in our world report. The Namalchi leader, Dina Smailova, she had to leave Kazakhstan a few years ago because of harassment against her. And she's now based outside the country. And we've documented how the case that the government has brought what appear to be trumped up charges against her and tried to extradite her actually back to Kazakhstan. So for a country where there's has been traditionally such a strong, vibrant women's rights organizations, it's really concerning that the government seems to be targeting these groups rather than embracing them and giving them space to operate. And we really hope that the case against Namalchi's founder and also Feminita, you know, are dropped in 2025 and there's opportunities for them to do their work, their important work, supporting women's rights in the country.
Okay, thank you. And we're getting close to the end, but I did want to cover one more topic. The big events of 2022 almost would be the unrest in Kazakhstan at the start, Kandy Kampar. We had unrest in Gorno-Badakhshan in eastern Tajikistan, and we had unrest in Qoraqalpakstan in Uzbekistan. The Tajiks haven't really investigated that, but it's still worth talking about a little bit. But Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan have conducted investigations, and yet, so I guess I'll start with you, Hugh, and then we'll go to Sianat about Tajikistan. But Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan have been investigating this. There's been trials going on. Have they made any progress in explaining exactly what happened and who's to blame on this?
I mean, the simple answer is no on both cases. I mean, in both cases, there was pressure, interest from international partners, the United Nations, European Union, OSCE, for genuinely independent investigation to what happened. I'll get to Uzbekistan in a moment, but in Kazakhstan, they rejected the idea of doing some sort of independent investigation, a broader look at the causes and the groundings for what sort of violence was used and how so many people, let's remember, 230 people, over 230 people killed on the streets of Almaty and elsewhere. The scandal of what's happened in the last 3 years is that perhaps a couple of dozen police officers and law enforcement officers have been prosecuted. And this year, there was one positive development. A former interior minister was given a 5-year prison sentence, suspended sentence, for his involvement in what happened in the January events. But literally hundreds and hundreds, we have a figure of 1,400 ordinary people who were allegedly involved in the protests or connected to the protests, have been convicted or prosecuted. That's a huge imbalance between ordinary citizens being targeted and a lack of attention to the law enforcement officers who shot the bullets, shot the guns, did the torture in prison in the days afterwards. You know, remember, our investigation showed that in four incidents, at least 10 people were murdered by police on the streets of Almaty. So it's a real scandal that there's been no proper investigation, and the government now is really trying to move on from what happened in January 2022. In Uzbekistan, the new development is that just at the end of December last year, the commission that was set up after the events in Qoraqalpakstan, in Nukus, in mid-22, so that investigation, like 2.5 years later, published its findings. Huh? We don't know what they are. Nobody's seen them. We have not seen them. We've asked diplomats and others what's in the report. The Senate published a brief summary of what's in the report. Nothing significant regarding what the key human rights issues are, which are, you know, how did the over 20 people die? What was the cause? Who's accountable for their deaths? Huh? Those information is not included in the summary produced by the Senate. That's what we'd like to know, and that's what the victims' families have a right to know, and what other ordinary people in Uzbekistan have a right to know. So that one's very open still, and we still call for a proper independent investigation with international experts to take place in Uzbekistan. So a lack of progress on both of those cases, and they do hang over the countries, particularly it's a stain on their international records, really, those two rounds of events.
Okay, thank you. The other one is, of course, Gorno-Badakhshan, which is different than what happened in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, because at least there, it was grassroots protests for the most part. But the situation in Tajikistan was actually sparked by the Tajik government, and that campaign is still going on. There is no investigation, as far as I know. But can you update us on what's happening in Gorno-Badakhshan?
Yes, I mean, there has been no investigation, or at least, investigation into the killings. Reportedly, the police had killed up to 40 people in the area during the so-called security operations. And that's really the reason, I guess, why the authorities do not even respond to any requests, right, from the international partners and international organizations for independent investigations into the crackdown, into what's happened in the Gorno-Badakhshan oblast, because the authorities' position is that it was a required military intervention into a region against known criminal gangs and extremists. Again, the usual securitization, right, of peaceful protest, really, in that sense. So that's why 2 years on, I mean, we're coming close to the third year anniversary of the events in the Gorno-Badakhshan. We still have no investigation, no accountability, no justice for the people who have been killed, for the hundreds of people who are behind bars, including, lawyers and journalists and human rights defenders that we've mentioned in the past, in the beginning of the program. And in addition to this, in 2024, the authorities had arrested 27 residents of the Yazgulom community in the region. And that has been happening for quite a while, right? So it's not just the one wave of arrests. And Yazgulom is a community in the Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Oblast. And they were suspected of being members of an Islamic group that's banned in Tajikistan, the Ansarullah group. But, what are the actual charges brought against them? That's also really not known at all. And what's more, even though, unfortunately, there has not been a very vocal response to the crisis in Gorno-Badakhshan. The international response really has been kind of muted to this. There have been some statements by the European Parliament, by the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights Defenders, Mary Lawler, but that's pretty much it. And against this background, we see, on the contrary, that there is increased or like growing security cooperation between certain European Union members, Turkey, with Tajikistan, which we believe is going to increase transnational repression on the part of Tajikistan, with, cooperation from these EU members and Turkey in that sense. One welcome, I mean, it's not really a development, but there was like a full-on kind of look into the situation in the Gorno-Badakhshan oblast by Amnesty International. They had published a research based on interviews with people from the region, with diaspora members. And I think we need more of these kind of attention to what's happening in Pamir, because mainstream international or regional media outlets are really not doing much on this, unfortunately.
Okay, thank you. And I'm sorry that we have to end the show now, because there's certainly a lot more we could talk about. But I'm looking forward to having you both on the program in the near future so we can talk about more rights issues in Central Asia. But for the audience, I would invite you to go to the Human Rights Watch organization website, hrw.org, and you can find the reports on all the Central Asian countries and other countries at that website. So thank you, Sianath and Hugh, for being on the program. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Medjlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Medjlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfrl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back in February.